But that's really what gets highlighted a lot. You know, can we have the flexibility to pay for different types of services, to pay for the air conditioner to keep somebody healthy and out of the ED? We now have that flexibility. So we now have dollars that are starting to go upstream that can pay for a community health worker or other services that that we couldn't do before. And that's really an essential piece for us. And then, of course, this $1.9 billion over 5 years. No small amount, but at the same time, if you look at the other side of the handshake, this is where I think the accountability really starts to come together. So we've agreed to lower our per capita spend 2 percentage points over the upcoming years. So we worked with CMS to get our baseline and then really looked at what the president's budget in terms of a per capita trend rate at 5.4%, and then we've agreed to ratchet that down in the upcoming years. So when we're putting this all together, if you looked at the ROI, that return comes out to about a $5 billion ROI over a 10-year period. So for this upfront investment, we're really guaranteeing this ROI to the feds. So that really, you know, made it much easier to sell. I think that when we initially had some conversations, the concern from the White House was, well, what if every state came to us and asked for a program like this? We said, you should take it. absolutely. But that was their initial concern, just, you know, what that upfront. And we had some mechanisms to get that 1.9, which I can get into later. But this is, I think, a lot of states, you can imagine, are very interested in how they can leverage this. But this is not an insignificant piece for us, this cost containment. And then the quality piece has been, I think, equally as significant for us. I'm going to touch on this. You may not be able to see this in the back, but this is really important. We just launched this last week, so our first cut at our metrics for our CCOs was released last week, and it's all online, and I'll give you the website. But we have it based on quality, on utilization, and cost, and we have baseline data that we've been capturing from based on 2011, benchmark data that we had a statewide metrics work group look at really national standards and best practices, and then we have some preliminary data up there. So we're now tracking, you know, how well we're doing in these outcome metrics and really starting to hold ourselves accountable, and this is really what CMS is looking at. So if we can't make significant progress, then that part of that 1.9 is going to be at risk for us in the future. So I'm not going to get into all these, but we have utilization data, a total of 33 metrics, 17 of which are really tied to performance pay for the CCOs. So we've agreed to a 2% withhold with our CCOs, and we're looking at ratcheting that up potentially to 5% and more in the upcoming years. So this just gives you another angle of what we've been showing, even started last week, of one of the 17 metrics for the CCOs. So on the bottom, we have all of our CCOs lined up, and we have a metric here in terms of enrollment in primary care homes. So our state benchmark is 100%. We've got a baseline from 2012 data at 51%. And then you can see how each CCO is stacking up. Now, I will say this is pre-CCO, but this was kind of in our previous managed care days, but it gives everybody a sense. And this, you can imagine, raised a lot of questions even last week when this was published. So it really holds a whole other layer of transparency that we haven't had. So this is another one on EDUs. So last closing comments here. I think our next step, much like what Ani was talking about with Vermont, is how do you take this to scale? And so what we've called, you know, healthcare reform 1.0, taking this first step with Medicaid, we now are looking how do you take it beyond that. And this is not just our CCOs. It's really what we talked about with these care models. So our next step is thinking, you know, how can we take those care model attributes and embed those within our public employees and our schools? So we have about 600,000 Medicaid. We've got another 300,000 public employees and school teachers. That's close to 1 million lives. We've got a state of about 3.5 million people. So we now are talking about some leverage to, you know, we're getting to that tipping point. We're then now talking about how do we take those care model attributes and embed those in the certification of qualified health plans for the exchange. And as I said, we now have large employers who are looking at this. So really trying to have, can you have a single really point to the delivery system and say, this is what we want to buy. instead of having this done in a fragmented way. And closing, you can kind of see this, as I touched before, I think Governor was just absolutely instrumental in this. Statewide engagement. Can't say enough about the competency of the Oregon Health Authority. For those of you, I think many of you know Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who's been heading that for many years. I mean, he's truly phenomenal. He's built a great team. So the state really has been seen with having a lot of competence to pull something like this off. Business community support, I can't emphasize enough. I mean, they saw this in relation to an opportunity to mitigate cost shift, and they got behind this, which really allowed, I think, the Republicans to get behind this and have some protection. And as I said, the bipartisan support. If you have follow-up, interest, we've got a website that has really everything on it, from all of our metrics to all of the backgrounds on CCA. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm going to try something new, which is work without slides. As I was thinking about this a few days ago, I was reminded of the time when I was working on NASA safety panel. And of course, we brought in all of the engineers working on the shuttle after the last shuttle went down. And we kind of discovered that they were trying to do systems engineering by PowerPoint. It didn't work very well. So I'm going to try doing this without PowerPoint and see how it goes. Because everyone in front of me has given you certainly the basics of where we are in the states with Medicaid continuing to grow, and we'll expect to continue to grow. The budgets and the revenues are about back to where they were in 2008, but because of the growth in healthcare costs everywhere, not just Medicaid, but employees and retirees, we still find this year that there are very few other things that are going up. Education has been cut over the last few years, K-12, higher ed, transportation has been cut, another usual state function, so the healthcare becomes one of the most important things for governors to focus on, even though they don't want to. At the same time, we have 35 governors now who have 2 years of service or less, so there's a bit of a blank slate to work with. At the same time, there's prospects for advancement because they don't have the political scars from previous fights that some of their predecessors had. So we think there's great opportunity here for states to do many of the things that you already heard about. I want to talk just in general about what we believe states can do and how we're trying to think about that. As Len said, of course, getting the incentives right are always critical. We start even more abstract than that in the sense of thinking about supply and demand. We think we can help states, and states can in turn help themselves by concentrating on the supply of health care, which in a minute I'll expand on, and they have a lot of control over, by reducing utilization, particularly of hospitals and nursing homes, by making prices transparent, and by making outcomes more transparent. So it is more of an Econ 101 exercise than it is anything else in how we think about doing things. The states have, of course, a lot of latitude. Our thesis was, starting a couple years ago, that the federal developments here were obviously critically important, but not much that states could control or affect. And so we tried to turn states back inward to say, what can you do despite or with any kind of federal health reform, whatever else we're doing in Washington? And so in that sense, there are lots of things, of course, states do that can affect healthcare within their domain. They're large purchasers of healthcare. Obvious, but we keep pushing them on this score. They not only buy, of course, for Medicaid, but their own folks. Some are required or run plans even for the local retiree health care. So there are literally millions of people with states buy insurance for outside the Medicaid system. But they don't think of it when they're writing contracts that it's a way for them to influence health care. As an example, we now have states thinking about incorporating behavioral health into physical health, something states haven't done very much in the past. They've had, as I think Mike just said, often buying physical health care from one company, behavioral health care from another, and never the twain shall meet. And we do have experiments out here in Iowa and other places that are trying to make them work together. We have a few states who combine behavioral and physical health in the same provider contract, but very few. And so contracting for behavioral health along with physical health is an important piece. Obviously, making prices more transparent can be required in the contract they write. Currently, states are too easily convinced that they can keep or should keep prices unknown. Many of you are aware of contracts that say thou shalt not reveal the discounts or prices we're giving you. and there's no particular need for states to agree to that, but they do it quite quite regularly. And then as we discover further and further, and Michael alluded to this as well, there are a lot of services that our most expensive patients, of course, need outside the realm of physical health care. We are going to, and I'll talk a little bit more about it, but try to expand some of the experiments people like Jeff Brenner have conducted, services where he's working at the local level, and clearly people need help with transportation or housing or nutrition, a whole range of issues that may be much cheaper than providing physical health care, but that Medicaid, for example, won't reimburse for. It's not just the air conditioners. There are a lot of things these folks might be able to use that will help. Communication is a critical piece of that we're experimenting with as well. Reminding patients of appointments, reminding patients to refill prescriptions. So there's a whole range of things in here that states can affect. That one of our theses is that governors are some of the few folks in the world who actually have purview over a range of services here that can be more easily combined at the state level. Governors have some purview over housing, transportation, and all of these other services that might be necessary to help keep expensive patients out of hospitals and nursing homes. And that's one of the areas we're going to be experimenting more with. Regulation, obviously, is an important piece of what states do. Healthcare insurance is just one of those. Medical malpractice, some of you have fought those wars. Requiring transparency can be part of what state regulators require of others, whether it's price transparency or outcomes. So the regulation of healthcare in states is important. Increasingly, we're finding antitrust authorities are becoming of interest to a lot of people. New Jersey passed a law 2 years ago, roughly, that would facilitate some of the Brenner-like activities at the local level, because Jeff will gather providers in the same room along with other services and essentially decide among them how to divvy up the money that they have. And of course, it makes antitrust folks very itchy. FTC actually asked for review authority over the regs that came out of the New Jersey law. They get very nervous about how we're combining services and how we talk to those providers and getting in the room is one of the things that makes them quite worried. So we're going to have increasing antitrust scrutiny of some of the experiments we have. There is an exemption in the law, actually, for most ACOs, because there was an understanding then that combining services, getting all these providers to coordinate care, could be of interest to antitrust. So that is coming and will bother states a lot more in the near future. We're going to try and get the FTC to actually issue some guidance so that we have a better sense of what they're most worried about. It is, of course, a little ironic when you work with any of these expensive patients down in the local level, because there's no competition for taking care of expensive patients. It's almost an upside-down antitrust concern, having a hard time finding people to want to take care of them, let alone having too many of them in an anti-competitive stature. So regulation continues to be of big interest, and increasingly so. Let's see. As I mentioned, I often tell governors that they have control over much of the supply of health care. And it's only a slight overstatement. As you, of course, think about it, as many of you have, it's the number of slots in med school, a state med school. The curriculum that's being taught, it controls the number of nurses being trained, what nurses can do after they graduate, how many dental hygienists do we have, how many hospital rooms, nursing home beds, if it's a certificate of need state, how many imaging machines. So all along the spectrum of healthcare, governors and states have a big role to play, licensing boards and others. Of course, scope of practice is something you've all thought about, and we're trying to help states promote, whether it's allowing dental hygienists to do more, whether it's nurse practitioners. We're actually putting out a series of papers on what increasing scope of practice might mean for both healthcare delivery and for a price. Last, of course, is public health. Almost every state has a public health department. Unfortunately, like at the federal level, public health becomes something that's the first thing to get cut off in budget exercises. We're spending nationally less than 3% of total health care costs on public health, and yet some of our most challenging health issues upcoming are probably more than public health than anything else, whether it's obesity, faculty.